Okay, but we have four or five public officials here who want to give you priority to testify so you get on with your busy schedules. So what I was trying to do is allocate some time, and I think we have it worked out right now. It'll probably require me to open a public hearing and close a public hearing and then go on to the next publicly elected official and then reopen the public hearings for the remainder of testimony. So what I'm going to do is open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 31, and I'll ask first Justice Gillette to come forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Gillette. I'm the Senior Associate Justice on the Oregon Supreme Court, which means only that I've been there longer than anybody else. pardon me, I need to apologize to you. I've been caught by some kind of allergy, and I'm fighting that, so I end up coughing a good deal. I apologize. I'm here to speak to you briefly about H.J.R. 31 and to urge you not to send it to the floor, not to pass it. And I recognize that you have been importuned and will be importuned by those who are persuaded that various public officials, usually judges, are simply not doing their job and that something needs to be done about it. And I thought that just briefly I would remind you of what rules are already in play with respect to reviewing the performance of judges without adding impeachment to the list. First of all, it's the fact that judges have to run for election every 6 years. And it's a fact that judges get defeated. Not always. Sometimes judges aren't even opposed. But if there is a significant dissatisfaction with the judge's performance, especially at the local level, the likelihood is that the judge will draw opposition, and there's a reasonable likelihood the judge will be removed from office. I've certainly, over the period of time that I've served on the bench and before that when I was a lawyer, seen that happen often enough, seen judges who had forgotten what their responsibility was to their community removed from office. I also want to remind you that judges can be recalled, and that judges have been, so that the recall process works with respect to judges. I want to remind you that there is a Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability which is responsible for considering complaints against judges and has the power to remove judges from office. If the judges are shown to have violated a code that the judges are required to follow with respect to the way in which they perform their duties, that code includes a requirement that the judges obey the law, respect the parties that appear before them, not take a case in which the judges have an interest, not do things like take bribes. I like to think we don't see much of that around here, but nonetheless, if a judge were to take a bribe, that would be covered. And in general, the commission has the authority to remove judges as well. So you've got election, you've got recall, you've got the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability, and at least one other thing that doesn't get mentioned very often, although I saw it applied once. Every judge in this state, of the Circuit Court, the Court of Appeals, the Tax Court, or the Supreme Court, has to be an active member of the bar. And so if a judge is subjected to either disbarment or suspension from the bar, the judge automatically loses the right to sit as a judge. So that's yet one more way in which judges face the possibility of losing their position. So what it adds up to is this. There are several forces impinging upon us as judges, all of which could lead to our removal from the bench or our disability to perform the work of a judge on the bench. Pardon me. And to add impeachment to this list serves no purpose that I can identify. In examining the materials that I have seen that have come from those who are proponents of the measure and one of the gentlemen from, trying to remember the name of the organization, Oregon Men's Association, was kind enough to give me his handout today, so that gives me more insight. I think the truth of the matter is this. There are people in this state who honestly believe that judges are not following the law. These are people who, to no one's surprise, have lost lawsuits, or who know people who've lost lawsuits. One of the characteristics of a lawsuit is it has two sides. and the people are usually mad at each other, and somebody has to lose. There's a tendency, and I would know this since I'm a basketball official, there is a tendency in any contest with both sides passionately wishing to prevail for the losing side to want to blame anybody except themselves. And it's commonplace for people to feel it's all the judge's fault. In other words, you shoot the messenger. And this proposal, at least with respect to applying to judges, I'll leave it alone with respect to the executive branch. This body is perfectly capable of having its own fight with the executive. It doesn't need my help. But with respect to the judicial branch, this is a situation in which people who are dissatisfied with the way judges have performed and who have lost lawsuits and who can't admit that maybe they should have, instead want to have one more try at getting at the judge to get even. They can't win the lawsuit anymore, so now they want to deal with the judge. Am I going to tell you that every judge performs his or her duties perfectly? Certainly not. Am I going to tell you that every judge makes every legal ruling on questions that come before the judge correctly? Certainly not. But we have an appellate process for correcting that. If the judge is influenced by improper motives or considerations, and there is any true evidence of that, we have a Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability, which is empowered to remove the judges from office who have behaved in that fashion already. If the complaint instead is simply that I don't like the way judges rule on this proposition or that proposition, I want you to think about that a little bit and see whether that's really the way you want to run the railroad. Every now and then you entrust my court, for example, with problems and questions which you can't solve for yourselves. You ask us to solve them in a hurry, and you intend to operate based on the answer, whatever it is. You take our word for it then. Do you really want somebody looking over our shoulder even in that respect and saying, well, you know, I don't like the way they ruled on that case. Let's see if I can persuade one legislator in a later legislature, one legislator that he or she ought to go to the speaker and persuade the speaker to appoint a committee, et cetera, to set up what amounts to an attack on the judge for the judge's particular choice or the judge's particular ruling. I don't think you want to do that. I seriously doubt that you want to. It's not that we're going to be particularly intimidated, to be perfectly honest about it. I will, for the balance of my career, and touch wood, the good people of the state haven't given me another 6 years. I trust I'll get to work for that long. But I will, for the balance of my career, do my job the way I understand I'm supposed to do it. And if you want to add impeachment to the messages sent to me, fine. It's not going to bother me very much. But I just don't see why you ought to. You've already got enough propositions and methods in place to deal with dishonest or incompetent judges. Any other reason for putting another process in place is based upon a desire to shoot the messenger. And as a messenger, as I said, as a basketball official, and as a messenger otherwise, I'm used to being shot at, but I don't see any reason to add to the list. And it's on that basis that I come before you and ask you on my own behalf, and I'm speaking today on my own behalf, ask you not to send this matter to the floor. But I will also tell you that, based informally on conversations with my colleagues, at least on the Supreme Court, I think my sentiments in this respect, I'm careful about saying this about much else, but my sentiments in this respect reflect the views of the entire court. No one has a sense that this would add a useful check on the judiciary as opposed to a perfidious one. Mr. Chairman, I had no other prepared remarks. I have done a bunch of research with respect to the impeachment process. I know that you've been informed that Oregon is the only state that doesn't have impeachment. My own research suggests there are a few others. Ohio, Washington, Hawaii, and the District of Columbia doesn't. I'm forgetting somebody else. There's at least one other state that does not as well. But the majority of states have impeachment in some form or other. And I just wanted to correct that misunderstanding to the degree that it is a misunderstanding. But the message is to the effect that many states, if not most, have impeachment, and that appears to be true. Whether those states with respect to the judiciary also have a Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability performing exactly the same functions is not something I've been able to research. That would take an enormous amount of time to figure that out. But I would suggest to you that even in states that have impeachment, if they had both institutions, the one that would function, the one that would work, would be the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability. because it's an agency with a budget, with investigators, with standards, and is up and operating. That's a far more useful way to do business. There may be those who feel that that commission in Oregon doesn't perform its job well enough. Again, I would submit that if you get deep enough into the background of those who complain about it, they are the losers in lawsuits. And so it's not surprising that they don't think it's performing well enough. They didn't win. It must be somebody's fault besides their own. And the truth is that usually it isn't anybody's fault besides their own. I'd be happy to answer any questions that anyone may have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Justice Gillette. Other questions from the committee? Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Justice Gillette.
Morning.
I am assuming that you are as good a basketball official as you are a judge.
I'm not sure which way that cuts, Representative Garrard. But
no. Well, if you make a bad call, as an official, we can boo you or throw something at you, as you indicated. But if you make what we think is a bad decision on the court, we go to jail if we boo you. So this is really about accountability, and obviously I don't think this was written with the Supreme Court in mind, but as a novice to this committee, as a novice to this judicial picture that we have in the state, there seems to be, and I also, by the way, might add, I did spend 3 years on the State Bar Disciplinary Board as a lay member.
Thank you for that service.
Thank you. But there seems to be, we have the police policing the police, and that lacks an accountability that is going to be a part of my decision on whether to support this bill or not. And I think I don't know if I'm asking a question here or not, but what other source of accountability does the average person have in regards to the court system, if not this?
Representative Garrard, members of the committee, that's a very fair question, seems to me, first of all. The answer is appeal. That's why we have the elaborate appellate process that exists in this state and exists in virtually every other state. If a trial judge makes an error, that's what the appellate process is for, to identify that error and to reverse the judge if the judge is wrong. And it happens every day. The Court of Appeals hands down opinions reversing trial judges for errors, some egregious and some minor, but nonetheless errors that require that the case be reheard. With respect to administrative law judges, I notice there's some concern about them too. Same process, judicial review, which is conducted either by a single circuit court judge under certain statutes or in the Court of Appeals with respect to all other administrative agencies. There is a review to determine whether the law has been followed or not. And that is the process by which someone is reassured. You use basketball as an example. The bad thing about basketball, of course, is that there is no appeal. That is to say, if I blow a call, and I do, all God's children do, and I'm among them, if I blow a call, there isn't anything I can do about it. And in fact, the one thing I have to be careful not to do is have that bother me and want to make a call in the other direction just to be fair about it. If you miss a call, you miss a call there, but there's no appeal. In the civil and criminal justice systems, there is an appeal. And in fact, there's two levels of appeal designed to identify those kinds of mistakes and correct them.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Justice Gillette, what I regard as the operative words in this bill, that is the standard for which a public official, whether a judge or otherwise, could be impeached, are malfeasance, crime, incapacity, or negligence. Now, crime and capacity, I think I understand, but in this context, I'm curious about malfeasance or negligence. Mm. I mean, negligence invokes the law of torts, which I'm not sure has any appropriate applicability to elected officials. Maybe there's something I'm missing. Malfeasance strikes me as so broad that it has to lack any meaning. Do you see anything that I'm not seeing in that language?
Representative McPherson, members of the committee, I did not intend to deal with the wording of the measure today unless asked, but I've been asked. The irony of all of this, of course, is that in one way or another, eventually, perhaps in a proceeding against a judge, an impeachment proceeding against a judge, somebody somewhere would have to resort to the judiciary to figure out what malfeasance and negligence meant. Malfeasance, of course, means an affirmative misuse of an authority or power in a way which egregiously violates the norms of that particular kind of power. Negligence simply means the failure, even momentary, to observe the standards that a reasonable person would observe with respect to the activity in question. At least that's what they mean in ordinary parlance in the law. Now, what they mean in this measure, I haven't got the foggiest idea. Consider, for example, that whatever choice might be made, let's assume that the measure was adopted in some form and it contained this language. One of the first questions that would have to be answered would be, would a judge's negligence in wandering down the hall and knocking over an apple cart, would that be a basis? It is negligence, and it's covered by the measure, so is that a basis upon which to impeach the judge? You may say that's silly, but it only demonstrates where you start on a continuum, and the question becomes how far you go. One might argue that, well, it's supposed to be negligence in connection with the way the judge performs his or her duties as a judge. But I'm not sure what the negligent performance of a judicial duty would constitute. I'm not sure how I would identify that. It's not a concept that's familiar to anybody that I know of. Malfeasance in office might get easier, although, again, it's a matter in the eye of the beholder. I do recognize, Representative McPherson, as I know you do, that impeachment is a political act, and always has been. It was a political act in England when Parliament first created the process. The House of Commons would prefer articles of impeachment, and the matter would be tried in the House of Lords. Impeachment has always been a political act. It's a political act in the United States. And therefore, it may very well be that because it's a political act, we don't ask people who have been elected on a political basis to confine themselves to legal norms. I wish we would, but I don't know that we do that. But I will tell you that from a jurist's point of view, I don't find either of those terms explicable, nor do I ever expect to be able to explain them if I'm stuck with being involved in any sense in administering them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. President Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Justice Gillette, for your testimony. You indicated that you thought that the likelihood of the origin of this particular endeavor is from those who have likely lost lawsuits. Now, do you come to your speculative conclusion by virtue of conversations with any of these folks or by virtue of any research that you've done with the impeachment movement?
I operate off of documents like this one, Ms. Flores, and anecdotal experience over a great many years watching people complain about the judiciary and finding that in virtually every instance, the original source is the complaint that a judge did something wrong, and the complaint is by the loser in that particular case. Now, sometimes the particular person who is unhappy is able to enlist a whole cadre of other people who take up that person's cause. That's what politics is about, and that's what free speech is about, and I've got no problem with that. That's just fine. But ordinarily speaking, I don't expect it to burgeon into a new constitutional impediment to performing our work. And particularly when appeal exists to review any legitimate complaint about the legal correctness of a judge's ruling. I'm not questioning for one second the sincerity, the honesty of the people who support measures like this. Not a bit. I know they're perfectly honest and sincere. In fact, they're passionately sincere. And there's no dishonesty involved in it that I'm aware of. But that doesn't keep them from being ill-advised or foolish. And with respect, this is both ill-advised and, in some respects, foolish.
Follow up.
Yes, you may.
Thank you. And you just made a phrase in your statement, a constitutional impediment to perform your work. Now, and you see this, adding this to the list of the already checks that are in place is a constitutional impediment?
I use constitutional in the broadest sense. Constitutional in the sense that it is part of the mechanism which either supports or impedes the capacity of you or me or the governor to perform our work. And I meant constitutional only in that sense. I speak in the British sense, not in the American sense. I beg your pardon. If you'd prefer, let's make it institutional. That an institutional impediment.
Thank you.
Okay.
Further questions from the committee of Justice Gillette? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gillette. Thank you, members of the committee.
I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 31 to accommodate some other witnesses that are publicly elected officials. And in that regard, to accommodate Representative Sumner, I will open a public hearing on HM4. Representative, please come forward.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Max Sumner, Representative, House District 18, which is Malala, Colton, Mount Angel, and Silverton. I'm bringing to you today a House memorial that's very simple in content and direct. And if I may, perhaps I should just read, I know you've all read this, but I'd like to read some portions of it that I've highlighted that will give you the context and the content. On line 9, whereas there is a near certainty that at least one vacancy on the Supreme Court will occur during the convening of the 109th Congress, and whereas there is a possibility that the need may arise to name a new Chief Justice of the United States from among the associate justices now sitting on the court. And further down, whereas President George W. Bush has expressed his commitment to appointing federal judges who will strictly interpret the United States Constitution, then we resolve, the members of the House of Representatives of the 73rd Legislative Assembly respectfully request that the United States Senators in the Oregon Congressional Delegation work diligently to ensure that their fellow senators act expeditiously in the event that nominations for appointment to the United States Supreme Court come to the Senate for a floor vote. Very specific. It's no hidden meetings or agenda that I can ascertain. It simply asks the members of the Senate to do the work of the people, vote up or down the appointments of the President of the United States. That pretty well covers it.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions from the committee? Representative, I have some problem with some of the language with respect to the recitals regarding activist judges and expressing, I guess, approval for the President's ability to approve justices that will strictly interpret the Constitution. And I have trouble with the language of regarding a minority of Senate members employing dilatory tactics. I'm not saying that. I am saying the President should have the unimpeded authority to appoint judges subject to Senate confirmation. Would you have any objection if some of that language was modified or stricken? I mean, some of the buzzwords in there, like activist judges and commending the President or asking the President to appoint justices that will strictly interpret the Constitution, would that be acceptable to you, or would you like to just rest on the memorial as stated?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, I totally agree with you. I don't think it serves a great purpose. If the President of the United States chooses a qualified judge and brings their name forward to the Senate, all we're asking and all this memorial suggests is that the Senate take the matter under consideration and in a majority vote either approve or withhold approval of that judge. I don't have any problem at all with removing some of those potentially damaging words.
I think, Representative, you're the only one signed up here this morning. There's another party out there that's going to want to testify later, so I'm going to have to come back to this. But what I may propose to the committee, because I know you have to go someplace else, is that we proceed into... make sure we can get into a work session today on this. And then maybe you and I could work out some amendments to present to the full committee that would be non-controversial. Just, I want to keep the process moving. I don't want to, come back for another public hearing to do what we can do today.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Okay, further questions from the committee? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, sir.
I'm going to have to, again, temporarily conclude the public hearing on House Memorial 4. Again, to accommodate some of our publicly elected people that are here this morning. And to keep that process running, I will open a public hearing on the House Bill 2912. Counsel, you want to tell us about this? Hunt and Anderson, I think, are here on this. You'd like to come forward while counsel is explaining this.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2912 prohibits a public body from substantially burdening a person's free exercise of religion, including when the burden results from the application of a rule of general applicability, unless the public body meets the burden of providing evidence and persuading the trier of fact that the imposition of the burden furthers a compelling government interest and is the least restrictive means of furthering the compelling government interest. This bill comes to you as something that I believe models the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act. That was an act passed by Congress after the Smith decision in the United States Supreme Court. That Smith decision changed previous application of the Free Exercise Clause enough so that Congress passed this act, the RFRA. The RFRA was subsequently found unconstitutional as applied to the states, so it's not applicable to the states. House Bill 2912, for all intents and purposes, I believe, attempts to model that standard, which would bring the Free Exercise Clause back into conformance with the pre-Smith decisions.
Thank you, Council. Representatives, Representative Anderson, Representative Hunt's pointing at you, so I think that means he wants you to go first.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, and the members for hearing this bill. For the record, I'm Gordon Anderson, State Representative from District 3 in Josephine County. History has always endured people who have attempted to force their ideas on others at great cost. In the past century, Adolf Hitler, Mao Zedong, Pol Pot, and others attempted to control millions of people whose thoughts or religious beliefs differed from theirs. Most recently, Saddam Hussein carried out murderous schemes against sects of his own religion in Iraq. America has been blessed with the four freedoms, as President Roosevelt expressed them, which preserve for all our people the ability to worship free of interference from government. Whether Jew or Christian, atheist or Muslim, or any of dozens of other parties, sects, or denominations, our founding fathers gave us the right to believe as we wish and not to be inhibited or curtailed by political interference. Compulsion to believe or not to believe has not been acceptable for our people. Freedom of religion can mean freedom for government to not be joined to any one of the major religions, for disallowing any state church. Indonesia and Saudi Arabia do not enjoy that privilege. Freedom of religion can also mean freedom from religion and that no religious persuasion would be tolerated. At times, the USSR and its satellites attempted to practice such a system. But freedom of religion may also be defined as the right of each individual to believe freely and openly in God or no God, with the ability to express those beliefs with courtesy and without interference from government or politics. I believe the American people historically have leaned toward the last definition of religious freedom, and I strongly believe we need to protect that concept tenaciously. Just as parts of the Middle East claim Islam as their host culture, and India claims Hinduism or China Buddhism, so Christianity has been the host culture in America. But differing from any other part of our world, our freedoms allow any person to practice their beliefs without inhibition or without our religious beliefs being curtailed. This bill protects that free exercise of religion, and all religions, Catholics, Jews, Mormons, atheists, evangelicals, New Agers, anyone should be free to practice their faith or non-faith without being suppressed by government in America. Failing to protect and restore our historic religious freedoms, as happened in Germany, in China, Cambodia, in Iraq, could lead to the light of freedom being extinguished here in America. I urge you to vote for House Bill 2912 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today and for hearing this bill. I will point out that neither my colleague nor I are attorneys, so please go easy on us. We have the criminal element of your committee over here on the side to protect us in case that goes awry. Your counsel did a good job of giving the background. Let me just give a little more background as I understand it. Again, if we look at the U.S. Constitution, the First Amendment to the Constitution, there are generally two clauses as it impacts religion. The Establishment Clause, which talks about Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion, and the Free Exercise Clause, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And I think as we look at these issues, they really go hand in hand. This legislation deals with restoring the Free Exercise Clause, but it really is very consistent with at least my understanding of how those two go together. At the time of adoption of our Constitution, and for over 100 years thereafter, the Bill of Rights was only applied to the federal legislature. But gradually, the rights guaranteed under the Bill of Rights were extended to state governments through the 14th Amendment, the Due Process Clause, and then through specific court decisions in 1940 that applied the Establishment Clause to the states, and in 1947 that applied the Free Exercise Clause to the states. I'm sorry, that's the reverse. The Free Exercise Clause in 1940, the Establishment Clause in 47. And since that time, that has really opened the floodgates. The Supreme Court has heard numerous cases concerning religious freedom issues. The one major, let me just kind of skip through my testimony a little bit, especially as we've looked at the last 50 years in light of an increasingly spiritually diverse country, as well as really a country where spiritual resurgence has been occurring in the last 50 years. There have been a whole number of cases. I mentioned in my testimony some of the issues under the Establishment Clause there, but let me skip to the Free Exercise Clause, which is the real subject of this legislation. That Free Exercise Clause, the Constitution, has generally been interpreted by the court to mean that people may believe anything, as my colleague said, but that actions and rituals may be limited by law of the government if the government has a compelling interest, and only if the government has a compelling interest. Laws passed which are aimed at restricting a particular religion are unconstitutional. And the case which, as your counsel, Mr. Sears, indicated earlier, the case that prompted all this decision happened to be an Oregon case that made it to the Supreme Court, the Smith versus Oregon Employment Division case, where the court ruled that the Free Exercise Clause doesn't exempt a person from drug laws. It was a case of an employee dealing with, a Native American employee dealing with use of a certain drug as part of their religious practice. That decision, though, completely changed decades of legal understanding by saying that the new rule, which declared that no religious actions may violate general laws, but that laws aimed specifically at religions or at a particular religion are unconstitutional. The fact that this new rule under that court decision relieved the government from proving that it had a compelling interest was the underlying problem. By removing that compelling interest standard, it then completely changed the balance of weight. Instead of saying the burden is on the government to demonstrate that they have a compelling government interest in order to restrict free exercise, it shifted that burden functionally back on the individual. So the individual person practicing their religion therefore had the burden, which I think was inconsistent with the intent in the writing of the First Amendment originally, and certainly inconsistent with decades and decades of judicial decisions over time. That's why Congress came back almost unanimously. I mean, if you want to look at decisions in Congress that have been divisive, this was not one of them. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act that passed Congress in 1993 was passed almost unanimously. And it restored that standard. It restored that compelling government interest standard, so the burden is on to the government. They can restrict the free exercise of religion, but they have to demonstrate a compelling government interest to do so. As your counsel said, that then was thrown out, not on the merits of the case, but on the fact that that it overstepped the federal government's right to apply to states. So as a result of that, over the years since that decision was made, states have been going through one by one and adopting Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, using language almost identical to this. and that is really why we bring this before you today. This doesn't take any completely new tact. It simply reapplies that standard that was true prior to 1990, that was true after 1993 when Congress passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that there is a burden when government wants to restrict the free exercise of religion, and that burden is understandably and justifiably on the government. You will hear today, and you will hear from your constituents, that this legislation is supported by a tremendously broad range of religious groups, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, other. You also hear today, and perhaps from your constituents, that it is opposed by a wide range of government interests, which really makes sense, because the burden, if this passes, is back on the government to demonstrate, if they're going to restrict the free exercise of religion, they have to demonstrate a compelling government interest. It really is a choice, I think, for you all and for all of us about where that burden should understandably lie. This would make it consistent with, I think, what the founders of the Constitution intended and what has been the practice in America and in Oregon for most of our history, except in the last few years as we've endured these Supreme Court decisions. So I urge your support for House Bill 2912. And we'd be happy to take any questions or defer those questions to the religious and legal experts who sit behind us.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions from the committee? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I offer this question to both of you. Is it, my initial reaction is it seems like a very theoretical bill. What particular problems is it trying to solve here in Oregon? What's happening to Oregonians this bill would remedy, that we would be resolved differently? I just have trouble getting examples in mind about where this would have an impact.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson. One of the challenges in looking at the examples over the last 10 years, say, is we've had this moving target. The standard was on before 1990 and then off and then back on in 93 and then off when it was thrown out by the courts. Just to give you a few examples of cases that have come up, which have been at intermittent points in this process, there are cases, there's a case of Sunnyside United Methodist Church in Portland, where in that case the city of Portland was restricting that church as it was trying to provide meal programs to homeless and low-income folks as part of their religious free exercise of that congregation. That, interestingly, so they were restricted in their free exercise. They filed suit. It was ultimately resolved before it made it to court, really more for political reasons. I think the negative political consequences of restricting meal programs to homeless and low-income people played out there. There have been issues around suspects confessing to priests. There have been issues around, as I said earlier, use of certain... used by Native American tribes of certain things as part of their religious free exercise. There have been issues around. There was a case fairly recently around a Seventh Day Adventist school who was their basketball team made it into the state playoffs, which is a great thing, but then their game happened to come up on a Saturday, which was in violation of their religious beliefs to do that activity on their Sabbath. And so rather than simply moving that to a Friday or some other day, they told that team, you have to forfeit, that the burden was on them, not on the government, to accommodate their religious free exercise. So there are a whole variety of cases like that. There are lots of others across the country. You will notice that in the bill we brought forward, we have specifically taken out issues related to land use, really for two reasons, at least from my perspective. One, those have been subsequently covered by legislation that Congress passed, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, or LUPA as it's known, which really take, as long as that's in law, takes care of land use issues, establishes that higher standard for land use issues. Also, I think in light of Measure 37, to add another land use issue into this legislature seemed to me in a way to be unwise.
Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Representative Hunt has certainly covered the answer quite well.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. on that state or on the city case in Portland, where the question wasn't so much about feeding the homeless; it was about the homeless then drinking their wine and going to the bathroom on the neighbors' yards and so on. Was what the problem was there, and I don't think there's an objection to feeding homeless, as Portland does quite a bit of that, but it was had to do with other neighborhood related issues. And what I'd like to ask with this, under this bill, for example, I believe that homosexuality was really evil and a sin, and I owned a motel, and could I then turn down somebody who was gay that wanted to spend the night there? Could I deny public accommodation based on my faith?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, my understanding of the City of Portland case was that they actually went in and limited attendance at those Sunday services to 70 people. So regardless of what the reasons for that decision were, I just think it was a clear infringement on a religious free exercise for that particular congregation. I think in terms of how this will play out in terms of a specific case, you're far better off asking the attorneys, the constitutional attorneys that will follow us, unless Representative Anderson wants to take a shot. That's the legal interpretation.
Thank you.
I also have a question that's somewhat where Representative Barker was coming from. And let's just again assume a private landlord has a rental unit and he refuses to rent to an unmarried couple based upon religiously held convictions. And there's a law that says that you can't discriminate based upon marital status. So the prospective tenants then sue for violation of their civil rights as stated in Oregon law. This is still a controversy between private parties. Your act seems to prohibit such actions only by public bodies. Would this act apply or not?
Mr. Chairman, again, I think you're best off asking a constitutional attorney. My interpretation would be similar to yours, that this is about the government. When the government restricts the free exercise of religion, they are prohibited from doing so unless they can demonstrate a compelling government interest. I struggle to understand how this would apply to a party where you're dealing with an individual versus an individual. The larger cases are going to be dealing with a state agency, a city government, a school district, a county government, some other instance like that.
Thank you.
Are we really talking about the rights of two different parties? And that, I think, has to be left open to the judges to decide which right prevails.
Further questions from the committee? If not, representatives, thank you for your participation this morning.
Thank you.
And I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2912. And is Representative Brune here? Did he leave? I missed him. He left. Okay. I think what I'll do before we go back into the public hearings, we have a couple of work session matters. I'd like to get them off and out so we can keep the flow of the bills going to the full committee, because we may anticipate some time problem this morning. I'm going to open there, therefore, a work session on House Bill 2662 and have counsel explain this and explain what amendments may be necessary.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2662 was originally heard before the Civil Subcommittee on March 16th. This bill prohibits the Employment Department from disqualifying individuals who are victims or the parents or guardians of minor children who are victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking from receiving unemployment benefits if those individuals leave work or avoid other available work in order to protect themselves or the minor children from further domestic violence, sexual assault, or stalking. There are already provisions in law that protect some individuals of domestic violence. This bill and the Dash 4 amendments, I should point out, which we'll be considering, will expand that and change some of the standards. Specifically, it includes parents of or guardians of minor children who are victims of domestic violence. It also includes stalking and sexual assault, and it changes some of the standards so that right now it is interpreted that the individual has to be endangered at the workplace. This bill changes that, so the individual, if the individual is in danger at the workplace or elsewhere, and it further provides that the individual must only pursue reasonable available alternatives, not all reasonable alternatives, which is now how the statute reads.
Thank you, counsel. So we have to have a motion on the dash four amendments, is that correct?
That's correct.
Yes, Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash four amendments into House Bill 2662.
Representative Garrard moves the dash four amendments into House Bill 2662. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, that's allowed. Motion on the bill as amended, please.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would move House Bill 2662 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, or excuse me, recommended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard moves that House Bill 2662 as amended be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Yes, Representative Worth.
Mr. Chair, I just want to state for the record that I am a huge supporter of this bill, and it's very vital that we get this passed the session, and for those reasons and more, I'll be supporting it.
Thank you very much. Further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Florence excused. Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2662 is amended, is forwarded to the full committee with due pass recommendation with Representative Garrard as carrier. And when it gets to the full committee, I would like to request that Representative Holvey have an opportunity to be a carrier if this passes full committee. With that, the work session on House Bill 2662 is concluded. I'm going to open a work session on House Memorial 4. This is, we have one more witness on that, don't we?
Yes.
All right. Let me get my list out. I will reopen the public hearing on House Memorial 4 and call as the last listed witness, Jason Williams. Would you like to come forward, please?
Members of the committee, Chair Ackerman, for the record, my name is Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. I did testify on this bill about 2 weeks ago, so I won't spend much time, but just basically this is a resolution being proposed in all 50 state legislatures, just trying to predict that there might be a Supreme Court vacancy and that there would be an expedited hearing. And in the previous talk on this bill this morning, I really don't want to see really any changes made to the measure, because I think it's fair and simple enough. Although if you do want to change the word activist judges on line 13 to maybe overreaching judges or some other adjective that seems to work, or I'd be fine with that, but I would really like to preserve the language as it is. There is this points to a problem of where it is the fact that there are some lawmakers who feel that our president just wants to be able to nominate people that interpret the Constitution, just common sense judges doing their job as they should. So line 16 and 17 is just a very common sense perspective, but in doing so, there are people who do not like the president idea appointing judges. They would rather appoint activist judges, and so they use that as an excuse to delay, to not allow a floor vote. So what this bill, when in addressing the problem, it's addressing the fact that this is one of the reasons why some of our president's judges are not being nominated or having a fair chance for a vote, because an opposition side is saying, oh, they're out of the mainstream, therefore we feel obligated to do that. So that's why this simply addresses the problem in its very just basic generic terms. So, but I would just hopefully that this bill could be moved on without any changes or as the few changes as possible, and just moved out today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Representative Barker.
How many judge nominees has President Bush made and how many have been not allowed?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, I don't have the number. It is I'll tell you one thing, though. There is, it's been lower than it should, and for appellate court judges, where that's never was an issue before for, like, President Clinton, because some of his nominees were delayed, never before had they been, under the threat of a filibuster delay. But now we've seen 9 of these appellate court nominees being under that threat of delay and filibuster, and when you delay long enough, that some of them will eventually drop out. So we're actually seeing the use of this expanded like it's never been before in the history of the United States Senate.
Yes, you may.
So President Clinton didn't ever have any judges? He got all of his judges in?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, there are, as I said, there were some delays and stuff done with Clinton nominees. But I'm saying that what we're seeing now with the Bush administration, it's gotten even worse. And if you look at the numbers, it has gotten worse. And it's expanded into new areas, like appellate court judges. And when Clinton, all of his appellate court judges were sent through. They did not have these type of delay tactics used against them. So if we're seeing it now happening in the higher and higher courts, now we're saying, oh for goodness sakes, it's now going to happen with the Supreme Court. We don't want to see that happen. We want to see, Congress kind of be able to get back to some type of common ground working process. But and it may take the Supreme Court to finally be able to have everyone realize that this type of dilatory tactics, this type of delay, denying a person the right to vote, has got to stop. So that's why this is so important, because we feel it's going to come to a head with the Supreme Court nominee.
Thank you. Further questions? Again, thank you for your testimony. That does exhaust the registration list, but I did get a note from Stephen Green. And you wanted to testify on this bill? Please come forward, Mr. Green.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, I'm Stephen Green. I'm a law professor. When I'm at law school, I teach constitutional law, constitutional history. I'm actually here to testify on 2912, and so I'm not prepared to make any comments about this House resolution. But I just could not resist to at least make a couple of points. I oppose this type of House resolution. I think it is bridled with language that certainly is promoting a particular perspective about the current events going on in the Senate Judiciary Committees, and that I think is completely unnecessary. As some suggestions were asked earlier, this has been the practice by both parties consistently to call question about judicial nominees and sometimes to filibuster those. I don't have any statistics because I said I came here unprepared for this particular issue. But the point I'd like to make is that there are activist judges on both sides. We'll be talking in just a few minutes about 2912 and raising comments have been made about the Employment Division versus Smith case. On the free exercise, that was actually written by Justice Scalia in that instance when there was no briefing on that question about whether they should change the standards on free exercise. A very activist decision by Justice Scalia, who is quite conservative. Judicial activism occurs on both sides of the aisle. There's nothing unusual that's going on in the Senate right here. It's the advice and consent by the senators on judicial nominees. And as was suggested, the Republicans, when President Clinton was putting judicial nominees up, were consistently opposing many of his nominees on ideological grounds. So nothing new going on, and I would oppose this type of resolution.
Thank you for your testimony, and stay here in case we have a few questions for you. Questions for the witness? Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Green. You indicate that the filibuster technique has been used in other administrations. Could you give us some examples of filibuster in the Clinton administration or prior for Senate approvals of judges?
Like I said, I did not have didn't come with any specific examples. I know that it has been used in the past. So far as I know, there's never been a filibuster of a United States Supreme Court justice, and I think it is highly, highly unlikely that we would see that happen. What we're seeing today are filibusters of Court of Appeals nominees. Many of these Court of Appeals nominees have received, I would say, marginal types of evaluations by the American Bar Association. As I said, this is not an uncommon practice. Whether it gets to filibuster or not, many times these nominations die in committee when there's a failure for the full committee to vote on them. Republicans who are in charge of the Senate Judiciary Committee for the last several years, Senator Hatch, many times refused to allow the committee to vote on several of President Clinton's nominees. So this is a common practice to not allow certain nominees to go to the floor for full vote. That's the way the system works.
Thank you, Professor. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you again for your testimony and for participating this morning. Are there any further witnesses on House Memorial 4? Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on House Memorial 4. And I'm going to just state my position, see if I can get this into a work session. I oppose the bill as written, but I'm willing to make one try at an amendment for consideration by the full committee. So I would be giving this a courtesy vote to forward the memorial to the full committee with that reservation. Does anybody object going into work session at this time? Hearing none, then I will open the work session on House Memorial 4. Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, I would move HM4 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard moves that House Memorial 4 be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? I think I stated my piece. My yes vote is a courtesy vote pending an amendment.
I guess I can't resist offering up a comment, although I'm not a member of the subcommittee, but since it will be forwarded to the full committee. It's of very little import. The House Memorial is passed by the lower chamber of the Oregon legislature, and it just seems like such a waste of our resources to be spending time on this sort of politically charged statement at a time when we have other broader issues to deal with in the state. So I would not expect to support this under any form of wording that I would expect to come forward in the full committee.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion on the motion? Representative Garrard?
In regards to Representative McPherson, issues of freedom of speech are both subjective and objective, and we certainly honor the subjective arguments in this regard, but I would remind the committee they are indeed subjective.
Further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, then the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
No.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Memorial 4 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I'll close the work session on House Memorial 4. President Garrard, do you want to carry this one, please?
At your wish. At your wishes.
Thank you.
Sure.
You're so designated. Okay, my wish is fulfilled.
I didn't want to use the word demand.
Or command.
Yes.
All right, I'll reopen the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 31. And Mr. Thurber and Mr. Barlow, you're the last two witnesses on the sign-up sheet. So I can come forward. And I would like to have counsel explain the bill. I did not have to do that before Justice Gillette's testimony and the relevant amendment.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, I think it's relatively clear what the bill is doing. It's proposing an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to allow the House of Representatives to impeach certain elected or appointed state officials, including judges, also other officials as listed in the summary. It specifies the grounds for impeachment, and it requires a trial by the Senate. I have before you -1 amendments and -2 amendments for that I just received this morning. I haven't had a chance to review the -2 amendments. They look very similar to the -1 amendments. They're essentially setting forth the procedures that the House of Representatives would use to go through an impeachment process. I don't believe that they change the substance of the bill. They just add those further procedures.
Thank you, counsel. Gentlemen, you may testify. Who wants to go first? Go ahead.
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to recommend, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, thank you for your opportunity, for this opportunity to speak again. As you can tell, I'm no politician and I'm no attorney, so if I violate the ethic of speaking, I apologize.
Well, if you violate those ethics, sir, we'll impeach you.
Okay. Judge Gillette spoke with the elegance this morning regarding his opposition to this proposal, and I just wanted to address a couple of things that he brought up. One is about my personal background. I moved up to Oregon in 1979. My employment at the time was law enforcement, and after about a year and a half to 2 years, I moved up to Washington, lived up there for 10 years and engaged in law enforcement, and then I moved back to Oregon in 1989 and have lived here ever since. My own personal background, I have never been accused of a crime other than minor traffic violations. And you're welcome to check Ogen on this. And the only other activity I've had with the court system have been two small claims. One was a landlord-tenant dispute, which I won a partial judgment on. And the other was a small claims when a fellow took a car of mine and ran off without paying for it. And so I recovered the money from him. So that is my own personal background. And the reason why I decided to pursue this matter is that I've seen a few things in Oregon, and people that I know have seen a few things in Oregon happen with the courts and with the administration, like Mrs. Sees, who tried to develop a computer system for the state that didn't work and had to be scrapped, and cost the state about $250 million in override. And then that was due to incompetence and negligence. She didn't know what she was doing. And she was given a job by the governor after she resigned her position. She was given a job by the governor without a job description so she could finish off her retirement. Well, you and I would have lost our job, and we would have lost our retirements, and there was no accountability for her. And then another judge, like Judge Horner, with whom I've had no encounters in court, but he came to work so drunk he fell off the bench and messed his pants. There are things like that that I'm looking at. Incompetence, negligence. On page 2 of the pamphlet, which I distributed earlier, there are definitions of the things that that are mentioned, like malfeasance is on page 2, and you can take the time to read this definition, and these came out of Black's Law Dictionary. Incapacity, negligence, and incompetence are also defined on page 3. of the pamphlet. Mr. Gillette talked about the preventative measures that are already in force. Well, that's fine. Those are good measures, and they are effective when they are used. But they're not used very often. The only judge I've heard about getting disciplined recently was Judge Fadley. And that was a good call by the Commission on Judiciary Fitness and the Supreme Court. Another question that Mr. Gillette indicated was about frivolous complaints. And in H.R. 31, frivolous complaints would be dismissed very early in the impeachment process so that they would not come up to the House floor and waste the time of the House. And the other question that Mr. Jalib brought up was about other states. And I don't know where he obtained his information. The information which I have given this committee was taken out of the Book of the States, which is in your library, and it is in the pamphlet that you already have on pages 9 and 10, which indicate that the Oregon legislature is the only one lacking impeachment powers. Yes, we do have the recall laws in effect, which are good laws that work fine when an issue is local, small, and the people involved with the recall are all involved and know the issues and the people involved, and it works real well. But on statewide issues, they're not very well known, these issues and the people. And it's a very expensive process. It's a very long process. And it is not a very effective process, with about 56 recalls attempted in the last 20 years. I believe there was only 9 that came back with enough signatures to have a election on the matter, and only 5 of those were convicted and removed. Unfortunately, those were judges and prosecuting attorneys. Oregon is one of 16 states in the union that have recall laws, which indicate that a majority of the states of the union have not thought very much about the recall process. And I guess this concludes my testimony. I would appreciate your support on this issue.
Thank you. I'm going to just step out of turn for a moment because I see that Representative Krupp is here and he wants to testify on the bill. And considering his scheduling problems, I'd like to put him as a witness right now between the two of you.
Very good. No problem.
And just for a somewhat of a status check this morning, I have 14 remaining witnesses for 3 propositions and probably an hour to spend. So I'd appreciate it if you could keep that in mind. Otherwise, we'll have to continue one of the hearings to another time. Representative, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. Thanks for allowing me just a few brief moments, and I promise you I will be brief. I know that it's difficult for many of you to believe. I have a lot of bills up. I'm running between committee to committee this morning. Thank you. I'm here testifying in support of this bill. I introduced this bill on behalf of Mr. Thurber, who came to me during the interim time period, and I thought made a very interesting case as to why we should consider this. And that's why it is before you, and I support both the -1 and -2 amendments. Clearly, we will be amending the Constitution, or at least putting this out for the people to make a decision on and regarding to amending Oregon's Constitution as to whether they think this, if in their collective judgment, Oregon establishing an impeachment process is the proper thing to do. And keeping in mind that this does not change our recall law, it does not remove it, that is still an option that will be available. But frankly, I think the benefit of this is it's another tool by which the citizens can express their concerns to an elected representative, who then can judge them worthy or not, pass that along to the speaker. The speaker then can judge it worthy or not. The speaker then can choose to form a committee with equal numbers of the various party members. And they then can either choose to move forward or not. So there are a number of safeguards at every step. There are a number of very high hurdles that would have to be, and I can say hurdles because I used to be a high hurdler in high school. So you've got to jump through a lot of hoops to frankly, make this a reality. I think there have been cases in times past where this would have been appropriate. I think the recall provision, like Mr. Thurber makes a very good point, recalls work really well at the local level. They are much more difficult to do at the state level, as you know. California has been successful recently as one of the only in U.S. history to be able to successfully recall a governor. And they also, by the way, have impeachment statutes there, too. So I would consider you to move this bill forward to the full committee for their consideration with the dash one and the dash twos, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair, rather. And with that, I would take any questions.
Thank you for the temporary promotion.
I just hope it's not permanent.
Just don't tell the speaker, okay? All right, questions. Well, I think I'll go to our last witness, and then we'll take questions. Mr. Barlow, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may, forgive me, I need to go testify another one of my bills in another hearing. Thank you.
Excuse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Lane Barlow for Oregon Men's Association. And just that Gillette mentioned us, I gave him a copy of our testimony. You have our written testimony before you. Let me just hit some highlights here. The legislature has a direct stake in what's happening here. Article 1, Section 22 of our state constitution says the operation of the law shall not be suspended except upon authority of the Constitution. You'll see on the first page of our attachment that this is exactly what judges do every day. They don't care what laws you pass here. Good example that we found, particularly in the appellate process, is ORS 107-425, I think it's now subparagraph 7. This says that a judge has the option of meeting with a child of parents that are divorcing or separating, et cetera, in a custody battle in chambers, but that it must be recorded. Judges are having private chats. Judge Rhodes right here had one last year with a 13-year-old boy. It was off the record, yet her entire ruling expressed through her letters and decisions were based on what that child said in a private chat. It was not recorded. It has to be recorded. This is just one example. I have immense respect for Justice Gillette. He's probably, well, in my view, the finest legal mind in this state, particularly for what he did in the Noble decision. I've observed with interest what he said before this committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee in introducing the judiciary at the beginning of the session. It'd be great if the judiciary worked that way. Winners and losers, that's very simplistic in the way he presented that, is that these are just people with sour grapes. A lot of the people that we deal with are self-representing before the courts because they either can't afford lawyers or don't trust them. Now, people who self-represent, those typically they start with the laws and the rules, laws that you pass, the rules that the courts themselves pass, the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, Evidence Code, etc. And then you go to court and you find out that those laws, particularly ones that say shall, which you remove the discretion from the judges, is gone. Representative Girard, if I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, love what you said about the police or police and the police. The Commission on Judicial Fitness is a cruel joke. It consists of three judges appointed by the Supreme Court with no oversight, three lawyers that are appointed by the Oregon State Bar with no oversight, three citizens that are appointed by the governor with a Senate oversight. Now, that's a ratio of 2-1 right there. So you have the police, or the foxes watching the hen house. Just to conclude here, you know, we could go on and on with a book of transgressions, what judges do with this. That's, I'll just make a final comment on the two dash amendments that you have here. The dash one amendment takes care of our last paragraph. We don't see any mechanism in starting the process. The dash one amendments took care of that. We urge you to reject the dash two recommendments because that talks about appointing a special prosecutor. And unless that special prosecutor is a non Oregon State Bar member, then you're right back into basically your checks and balances being nullified. We have three departments of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary, and they are checks and balances for each other. And you, as expressed in Article 1, Section 22 and 26, have a direct interest in what the judges of this state are doing. So we urge you to pass House Joint Resolution 31 with the dash one amendments.
Thank you, gentlemen. Do we have questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the letter, I'm sorry, Mr. Barlow, in the letter that's attached to your testimony to the state's presiding judicial officers, are the cases that you selected all related to family law?
All but one.
Hold it, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you may.
And so I'm going to make sure that's right. Are you saying then that by suspending these laws in these cases, the outcome of these rulings then were unfair to overall to one party as opposed to the other in divorce cases, domestic relation cases?
Absolutely. And in the case with Judge Rhodes that I just related to you, her decision went according to what this private conversation she had with material witness in chambers, which you, the legislature, has said shall be recorded, and she refused to record. Judge Landau, we call him AWOP Jack because anybody who dares to come bring a brief without a lawyer, an appeal without a lawyer to him, AWOP's affirms without opinion automatically. He AWOP'd that one. But the law says shall. It's a no-brainer.
Yes, you may.
And so, then you're saying that these, by suspending these laws, then that the rulings weren't in non-custodial or the father's to his detriment, and more than in favor of the mothers or the custodial parents.
Fair question, Representative Worth. It's we don't just represent fathers. I've had non-custodial moms cry on my shoulder after to try to see their kids and get turned away, et cetera, too. It's not as simplistic as that. Not all of these are custody cases, and I erred. There's two, all but two are family law cases. One of them, which is the third bullet, for instance, had to do with a simple modification of child support and the contract that the parents made in their divorce, which was set aside by the courts. I won't bore you with the details. It's the Walsh case. But it went all the way from the circuit court all the way up to the Supreme Court, and it was a travesty of law. It was despicable what they did.
Sure.
Pardon?
Final question.
Yes, you may.
So would it be then safe to assume or deduct then if in these cases, if these laws had not been suspended, then the standing law then would have been in favor of the parties that are then the custodial, the non-custodial parents? Are those applying for, are the, I don't know how to say it would be politically correct. But,
I know what you mean, and we're not too politically correct. This is not a time for political correctness. When you have a judge that, for instance, takes one party and literally through the entire case argues that party's motions like a lawyer, and that party says nothing, and the Commission on Judicial Fitness finds nothing wrong with it, yeah, we have a problem there. But to directly answer your question, I'm definitely not a judge, but like Chief Justice John Marshall, who gave us Marbury versus Madison in 1803, Abraham Lincoln, so forth, who had little, if any, formal legal education, they read the law, that's how they passed the bar and so forth. I've been studying law for 12 years, and to me it's pretty simple. If the law says one thing and you, the legislature, don't give them discretion, and they rule against it as they just brush the law aside, there's something wrong. Judges do what they do because there's no consequences. The Commission on Judicial Fitness, as I said, is a cruel joke. It's the fox is watching the hen house. This government is set up with checks and balances. That's why we have three branches. And as I've mentioned twice in my testimony here, you have a direct interest in how the laws are suspended. It's upon your authority that the laws are suspended, not on a judge's whim.
I have one question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, one more.
So would you say that there's just as many, if you know, is it equal on both sides, or are there just as many examples that you could cite where laws were suspended and gone against your, or what your association would say in your favor, or those of, in your association?
What you're seeing here isn't just the tip of the iceberg, it's a sliver off the tip of the iceberg. There's many, 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 many more.
Thank you, Representative Garrard. You have your hand up.
Just a quick question, Mr.
Sure. Chair.
Justice Gillette indicated that impeachment is a political act. Yet the points that you've made in your papers really are citing particular incidents that have infuriated groups of people. Do you share the feeling? Are you motivated? Is this a political? Is your position politically motivated?
Absolutely politically motivated.
Good. Thank you.
You got your answer.
I did.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative Krieger.
I'm going to have to leave, Mr. Chair, in a minute, but I took some notes down. You may have not heard the words the way I did, but I was somewhat offended by Judge Gillette's comments this morning. He implied that those who support this bill or brought it forward were losers, and that they were dissatisfied in some case, and he had mentioned that. He also impugned those who supported the bill. And he had some word, and I missed the word, but it had to do not thinking or something of that nature, that the bill wasn't necessary. And I wonder if he would allow us to impugn him in his courtroom without having something to say. Just exactly what we see, arrogance from the courts. He felt free to do so in this room. I think there's one thing is, you know, as chair of this committee, I have always tried to have an open, fair, and respectful process. No one can deny that. I've got letters from both sides on many issues stating that. And I think that is also the same process we need to have in a courtroom. And I have been as a police officer in courtrooms and have seen times when there was a lack of fairness and there was a lack of what I would call the outcome we cause justice to be done. I'll just leave it at that. But in my own mind, if there was any doubt in my mind as to whether judges should be included in the bill, his testimony took that doubt from my mind.
The comments from the committee. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you.
I have signed up myself to testify on the bill, so I will take the witness stand, so to speak, as the final witness on this measure. I will try to be brief as the clerk is handing out my written testimony, which is just about a page and a half. But for the record, my name is Bob Ackerman. I'm a state representative from District 13. I am here in opposition to House Joint Resolution 31, and I will briefly summarize my comments. I want to preface that by saying that I did a search of both constitutional and civil and criminal law to determine what methods were already available to us to remove public officials from office. Aside from the comments made by Justice Gillette this morning. I think he was basically telling us about the disciplinary process, the recall process, and some of the other checks and checks and balances that may exist for the removal or discipline of judges. My comments this morning are broader than that. So the following is my testimony in opposition to House Joint Resolution 31. This resolution proposes a constitutional amendment to allow the House of Representatives to impeach certain elected officials. It specifies grounds for impeachment and requires a trial by the Senate. The impeachment proposal is unnecessary because there are a variety of ways by which a public official can be removed from office in Oregon without initiating the impeachment process. The Oregon Constitution specifically states that public officers shall not be impeached, but, quote, incompetencies, corruption, malfeasance, or delinquencies in office may be tried in the same manner as a criminal offense, and judgment may be given of dismissal from office, close quotes. That's Article 7, Section 9. This constitutional provision provides a trial with criminal law safeguards for the listed offenses. It's an easier and more expedient method of removing a public officer from the office rather than the laborious and politically charged atmosphere involved in the impeachment proceedings. Again, there are several other methods by which a public officer can be removed from office under current law. ORS 137.010 sub 8 provides that a sentencing court in a felony criminal proceeding may enter a judgment to, quote, remove a person from office, close quotes. In general terms, therefore, the conviction of any felony can subject a public officer to removal from office in the discretion of the sentencing judge. Article 2, Section 7 of the Oregon Constitution provides that if a person shall be disqualified from holding office during the term for which he or she may have been elected, if the person has been given or offered a bribe, threat, or reward to procure the election. ORS 30.510 sub 2 appears to be the vehicle for the removal of a public officer from office. This statute authorizes the commencement of an action at law in the name of the state of Oregon when a public official commits an act which allows for the forfeiture of the office. In summary, therefore, a person can be removed from office if convicted of a felony. Removal is also authorized under a civil suit brought by the district attorney if the public officer commits, quote, incompetence, corruption, malfeasances, or delinquencies, and for the offering of a bribe, threat, or reward to procure an election. In each instance, the public official is entitled to a jury trial. This is a superior method than the trial by the Senate, a process that is rife with partisan issues and lacks procedural safeguards. H.J. 31 is also inherently defective. The impeachment process extends to agency heads, all of whom are not publicly elected. Once again, partisan differences, which frequently exist, should not lead to the impeachment of agency heads. The grounds for impeachment include negligence. This is the lowest standard of legal responsibility. It should not form the basis of the drastic remedy of impeachment. This will conclude my remarks, and I'll make some statements with respect to the merits of the resolution when I resume my position. I'm happy to take questions.
Who's presiding? Sam!
I think you ought to just go for it, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair, thank you very much for your well-researched insight. However, I would ask, in regard to page 1, Print 2, and the citation to the Constitution, which you have also referenced on the second page, that a person holding office during the term shall be disqualified from holding office during the term for which he or she may have been elected if that person has been given or offered a bribe, threat, or reward to procure the election. Now, that seems to be a very specific incident and perhaps does not reach the overall and broad concern that is being brought forward in the substance of this resolution.
It's a narrow recital of grounds, but I did wanted to point it up as one of the alternatives. I don't see that happening in Oregon, but on the other hand, it does illustrate that there are constitutional statutory methods from removing a person from office.
Thank you.
Is there further testimony on this, on House Joint Resolution 31? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 31. This is on the agenda for a possible work session. I'll ask if there's any objections if we move into a work session. Hearing none, I will open the work session on House Joint Resolution 31. The chair will move that House Joint 31 be forwarded to the full committee with a do not pass recommendation. Discussion?
I certainly concur with the chair's views about this this resolution. I think it's an unnecessary complication of our political processes in the state, and I think it's driven by an ideological perspective. So, but I think it moving it forward to the full committee is an appropriate thing to have a larger debate among the full panel of committee members.
Is there any objection to? Any further discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair, are we going to consider the amendments?
I'm not processing any amendments by motion. I'm just doing a motion to forward it to the full committee with a do not pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, discussion.
I will be voting a cursory vote against your proposal not to move the bill. And I appreciate Mr. Thurman's -2 amendments, considering the suggestion I made.
So. Mr. Chair, I would like to have a point of clarification.
Yes. Then.
You are moving that this be forwarded to the full committee, so I would vote yes. Your recommendation is do not pass. So, and I don't support your recommendation, so how would you suggest I properly vote to reflect my view on this?
To vote no.
So either way,
and then if the motion fails, you can make a substitute motion to move it to the committee with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you.
You'd have that option.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Further discussion on the motion? I'll restate the motion. That is that the House Joint Resolution 31 be forwarded to the full committee with a do-not-pass recommendation. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Flores?
No.
Representative
Garrard? No.
Representative
Worth?
No.
I'm sorry.
No.
Thank you. Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Motion fails on a tie vote.
This is 3-1. This is Representative Worth voted no.
Excuse me?
Representative Worth voted no.
Hey, Mr. Chair, 3-1 is not a tie.
Did I count wrong?
Yes, sir.
Okay, then the motion failed.
I'll be back.
All right.
I did not say that. Mr. Chair, I would move House Joint Resolution 31 to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that House Joint Resolution 31 be forwarded to the House with a do-pass recommendation. Further discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I believe you have -2s to consider.
All right, we should go back and do the...
Strike that.
We'll hold your motion in abeyance and we'll do the amendments. Representative Garrard, you have a motion on the -2.
I would move the -2s into HJR 31, Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrard moves the -2 amendments into House Joint Resolution 31. Is there any discussion? Any objection? That's allowed. Representative Flores, would you like to renew your motion?
I will restate my motion, Mr. Chair. That would be to move House Joint Resolution 31 to the full committee as amended with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that House Joint Resolution 31, as amended, be forwarded to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation. Further discussion on this motion. Representative Worth.
Mr. Chair, I'll just restate again that I'll be providing a courtesy vote to get this to the full committee in favor.
All right. Further discussion. Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
No. House Joint Resolution 31 as amended is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. And I will close the work session on House Joint Resolution 31. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2888. I have four people signed up. I think Representative Barone, I've lost him, so we're down to three. Mr. Barlow, Jan Erickson, and Sally Royston. The three of you like to come forward, please. Council, would you like to explain the bill for us?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2888 requires the court to consider the geographical distance between the parents when determining custody of their minor child in a domestic relation case. In determining the custody of a minor child, right now a court is supposed to give primary, or is commanded to give primary consideration to the best interest and welfare of the child. ORS 107-137 sets out, I think, six specific factors which are listed in the summary that the court must look to, and the court is required to look at each of those factors. As mentioned, House Bill 2888 provides another factor that the court would be required to look to determine the best interest of the child.
Thank you, counsel. We have two witnesses. You may proceed in any order. State your names for the record.
My name is Sally Royston.
All right, and you'd like to continue with your testimony and maybe come a little closer to the microphone.
I'm a little nervous.
That's okay.
It's interesting what is involved here is kind of tied to what has been going on in here. So I'm glad I'm getting to speak today. Ladies and gentlemen, elected officials, my name is Sally Royston. I have lived in Westland for 20 years after moving here from Pennsylvania due to a job opportunity for my ex-husband. Because of an unfortunate and unnecessary custody battle, my motherhood has been stolen from me, and my young boys, now quite 11 and 14 years, are motherless, 2,000 miles away. Our marriage failed after nearly 21 years due to the stress caused by my ex-husband being diagnosed near death with a rare endocrine disorder and genetically passing it on to our sons. The divorce was bitter. He remarried quickly, and within time, life settled down to a dull roar. When May Company merged its Portland and L.A. offices, his executive position with Meyer and Frank was eliminated. He wanted me to move wherever he could get a job within reason, most likely St. Louis, Missouri. I had moved out of the family home, which I couldn't afford, into a home of our own, across the street from the middle school, and was well established in my job. He offered me a lot of money to move, more money throughout the first year, and visitation with my children, even though I was the custodial parent and always had been. I refused, of course. My boys' doctors, teachers, friends are here. My family is in Northern California, a short distance. With this said, his only way, as far as he was concerned, was to start a custody battle and hopefully win, something we don't see very often unless there is neglect, abuse, drugs, and or alcohol involved. I'm a great mother. I dote on my children. I know a great deal about healthy living. My children were never sick. I volunteered weekly at their schools while working full-time, something I had to do as a divorced single mother. I was a wife and mother before. My children were my career. Her case was pushed back because the judge we were to go to had a case more important than ours. We were told to mediate. That was a waste of money. Pete wanted the boys to see as little of me as possible. The mediator said, "Remember, Pete, you might win the war but lose the battle. These children really need their mom." January 14, 2003, we appeared before Douglas Van Dyke, a man who only recently had been appointed as a family court judge in Circuit Court, 5th District. This man was a construction lawyer, was appointed as a political favor by former Governor Kitzhaber. They both used the same attorneys, I've been told. This man had no family background at all, but he was appointed over many attorneys who had worked for years in family law in Clackamas County. He lives and still does in Multnomah County. We were his very first case. I had teachers, school counselors, school psychologists, dear friends as witnesses. My ex-husband had the custody investigator as his only witness. She said in her report that his home environment would have more emotional stability. He was married, and I had had some depression in my past. She also said that her decision was based on both parents staying in the Portland area, and if he had to move for employment, the children should remain here. She said it was not in the children's best interest to be moved out of state and away from their mother. My ex-husband paid her fee since he had the money to do so, but he had also met with her privately, something my attorney and I were not privy to. After over one and a quarter days of testimony, Judge Van Dyke said he didn't want to make a decision. It was too gut-wrenching. Therefore, he wanted us to leave and compromise. Unfortunately, this was not possible. Therefore, Judge Van Dyke made his decision. He wrote that it was in the best interests of the Royston children for the father to have full custody so he could recognize his full economic worth, and gave him the go to move anywhere he could find a job and take the children with him. I was devastated, as any mother would be. Within a short period of time, the children had to move to his home nearby. I saw them very little, as the law states. Pete started working within a month for May Company again in St. Louis. He moved our children when school ended, 2,000 miles away. I get $750 per month in spousal support. I sent him back $614 in child support. It was $693 at the beginning. He deducts the support. I claim it as income. I'm a low-income woman. I barely survive. He has to put $350 aside every month for airfare for the boys, or I'm allowed to visit six times a year. I went at first, and then it became financially impossible for me to go anymore. I hope this audience doesn't think I gave up. I appealed, of course. After months and months, we had our hearing here in Salem, 15 minutes worth. Within a couple weeks, the judges responded by only saying they were going to let it stand. No opinion was written, something they have done in the last 77% of their cases. It wasn't life or death, just the lives of two little boys and their heartbroken mother. We then appealed to the Supreme Court. They refused to review our case. No one would do the right thing. The appellate court also awarded my ex-attorney fees, over $7,000, a man who earns over six figures a year, drives the cars, has the toys. We appealed again, and even though there is a statute that says they have to respond in writing their reasoning, they didn't. We sent it to the Supreme Court. As usual, they wouldn't even bother. My ex is probably going to try to garnish my small wages and put a lien on my home. I already had to take money out of my home to pay my attorney at first, the first time around. I'm just existing. My ex-husband records most phone calls to my children and at one point stayed on the phone and interjected his comments. We can't talk freely as mother and sons. They want to be here with me and their father knows it. They wrote to an attorney asking for help. The law states that they shall get representation if they have written and asked for one. Before we go back to court on that one, we have to mediate parenting time with a court-appointed mediator, something that has already failed and it hasn't even begun. I have pictures, audios of their births, a video of Maxwell. My heart is broken. Nothing will make up the loss of my children. I witnessed every sporting event my children were involved in. I see nothing now. I'm never sent pictures. I still send them the magazines they used to get here, always with a loving card enclosed, telling them how much I love and miss them, telling no one will ever love them more. I sometimes get late calls from my older son, Shelby, crying, hiding somewhere in the house or in the garage, telling me he misses me and needs a hug from me. Sometimes he calls and tells me he can't sleep. He wants me to help. What can I do? I'm 2,000 miles away. You can't imagine what this does to a mother. I'm involved with a wonderful man who is a constant support for me. He has two great sons that get along great with my sons. Unfortunately, a part of me is gone. My children should be here with me. Judge Van Dyke did not follow ORS 107.169, which shows what is in the best interest of children in regards to a modification in joint custody. He did not follow ORS 107.137, which deals with emotional ties between children and their mother, continuing existing relationships. The Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability looked into Judge Van Dyke, but since he did not show any improprieties, was not abusive, under the influence, etc., they took no action. I would personally like to thank Representative Bruhn for responding to my plight and initiating this bill. I am here today to ask you to vote yes on House Bill 2888. Please don't let this happen to another parent. Please don't let children see one or the other parent a few times a year. Please let Shelby and Maxwell know what has happened to them will never happen to another child. I will never stop fighting for my children's return. They are and will always be my life. Please vote yes on House Bill 2888. Just thank you very much for hearing me.
Thank you for your testimony. And what I want to do is try to narrow this down. The bill would add one more factor to the determination of custody, and that is for the court to consider the geographic distance between the parents. And we need to focus on that, not everything else that happened in your dissolution case, because we can't reverse that decision.
Of course you can.
But we can change the law. So with respect to the next witness, I think we really need to know how this bill would help or hinder you in your objectives before the committee. Okay? So we'll take your testimony now.
Well, my name is Jan Erickson, and I live in West Lynn, and I am a longtime friend and neighbor of Sally's. We have townhouses together, and we adjoin each other. I didn't submit any written testimony because at the last minute I found out that I was available to come. But I do want to say that this bill, you're right, this bill, House Bill 2888, would include one of the considerations for custody to be the geographical distance between parents. And I have witnessed the difficulty, the increasing difficulty financially that Sally has been under to make those trips. And so, of course, now she isn't able to make them. And it has been very, very difficult for both her and the boys to see each other less and less and less. So I don't have a lot to add except that I have witnessed the pain from both the mother and the sons in not having that bond. You know, I've often thought, I've encouraged Sally very much because, you know, many of us feel that she did lose in the judicial process, to become proactive, and she has done that. And I'm very proud of her today and her efforts to go forth and try to get some legislation passed to help other parents. You know, in the testimony earlier, people in the judicial system win and lose, and sometimes both people can be very good people. And in this case, it was heart-wrenching for the mother of the children, but what I have witnessed also is the difficulty for her to even see the children, and just the financial burden of that because it's geographic distance. So I also urge you to support this bill, which does include geographic distance, so that children of divorced parents can keep that contact and that bond with both of them. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee of these witnesses?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Worth.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I'm just trying to get this clear, because as I read the bill as it's written, the geographical distance between the parents when custody was initially awarded, as well as upon this reconsideration of custody when it was awarded to your ex-husband, considering the geographical distance between the parents at that point would have been a moot point because you both lived in Portland.
But he was unemployed and needing to move out of state. But not at the time.
Hello?
You may.
So that's what my question is. There was no geographical distance when the custody decisions were actually made. And then the second decision, when the custody was awarded to your ex-husband, was it fully known that your ex-husband was not going to be living in Portland, or there would, pending very soon, be a geographical distance between the two parents?
When this happened, yes.
Okay.
Okay, one more. Sure.
So, how I understand it is that you're asking that it just be considered the geographical distance, not how it would be considered. So, how I see it is that the fact that he challenged you for custody and the whole issue of that there's going to be a substantial change in the circumstances, this move, it was being considered. That will trigger an appeal or a motion to the court to have custody reconsidered based upon a change in circumstances, and one could be a geographical move. Okay. So I think the court already considers it because it's a trigger for reconsideration of custody. I think what you're talking about, though, is a much bigger problem and a much bigger issue is just the relocation of a parent after custody has already been decided. So it's a huge issue, Mr. Chair, and I would like to talk with you further about it, but I think this wording is not getting at what you're trying to get across.
Well, when we were in court originally, he had been unemployed and basically said that it was going to look very likely that he was going to, at his income level, have to make a move out of state. He'd been unemployed for 7 months.
and the judge and everybody were well aware that there were opportunities out of the state of Oregon, and he, as soon as the ruling was made, he would make a decision whether he would stay here and suffer economically, as he states, or take a job that he could have had months prior in St. Louis, Missouri.
Okay, further questions from the committee? Seeing none, again, thank you for your testimony and your participation, and I see Representative Bruhn in the background has having suddenly reappeared at the opportune time. Please come forward, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Ackerman and committee. One of those, for the record, Scott Bruhn, State Representative from House District 37, which is Tualatin, Westland, Stafford. One of those mornings where I had two of my bills in my committee also being heard at 8:30 and just broke, so it was fortuitous timing to wrap up when you called down there, so thank you for that. I did have some testimony. I think it's being passed around right now. This came to me, Sally actually first contacted me back in November, I think it was, and brought her specific situation to my attention, and she had some ideas that she had. She talked to some folks and had some ideas that my office looked at. And basically, when we, and having said that, I think all of us that are in elected public official positions have to be duly careful when we look at issues like this, when we look at especially child custody cases, and we have to have, if you will, a little bit of an arm's length distance from specific cases, because I don't think that's necessarily the best way to legislate, and Sally and I have talked a little bit about that. Having said that, when I looked into statute, her point to me was hit home, was absolutely correct. When I looked into statute, I was actually surprised to find out that of all the things that courts and judges do look at when they are determining custody and determining the best interest of the child, geographic distance was not among them. And there's no questions. My testimony points out that, my written testimony points out that what is the paramount issue is what is in the best interest of the child. If the best interest of the child is to be 3,000 miles away from one parent or another, and somebody can objectively make that case, that's one thing. But when that's not the case, I certainly think geographic distance should be, I've come to believe that geographic distance certainly should be considered. I look at this, and as I also spelled out in my written testimony, there are so many factors that go to a child's well-being that have to do with place, have to do with where the grandparents are, have to do with where you were born and where you may have spent 5, 10, 15 years of your life, your schools, your communities, your churches. And I think all of that, as well as the other parent, as well as the parent that is in that place of origin, if you will, all of that should be taken into consideration when a court looks at adjudicating a child custody case. So that is, this bill is not designed for that to be a preeminent form. It's merely designed to put that in the thinking, in statute, in the thinking for a court to make the decision. And Representative Worth, your comments that I heard back there, I think were absolutely right. In Sally's particular case, this really doesn't make a difference. But it does two things. It could potentially avoid a case where that is a known factor prior to a custody decision, where somebody is moving halfway across the country, LC has left this fairly vague. We don't want to get into a position where we're measuring miles and where 1,000 miles is different than 2,000 miles. I think it needs to be a little bit open and a little bit vague for the court to have the discretion. But I do think it's something, though, that needs to be in statute. So not only in that initial case, but also in subsequent retries, if you will, if there are things that happen that a particular case has to be looked at again, I think having that in statute, at least as one of the considerations, is good public policy. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions of the representative?
Chair.
Representative McPherson.
Just taking off on what Representative Worth was exploring, it does seem as though maybe the wording of the bill doesn't get at the problem that is you're attempting to solve, in that the geographic separation is equal between the two parents. I mean, they are a certain distance apart, and that's the nub of it. And really, the argument I hear being made is that quite aside from where the two parents are, that there is a connection to place that is important to the nurturing of children. And I wonder if, seems to me that would be the really what the bill ought to get at, that that's an element in the custodial decision. Reactions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson. I think that's a great point. I absolutely think that's a great point. I think the reality of, that we have all seen, we see individual cases. Unfortunately, I have a friend that's going through, and it's subsequent to this, so I can't say that it's related, but subsequent is sadly going through divorce proceedings. There's, once again, coincidentally, there's a chance that one of the spouses is looking to move to Bosnia, all the way across the country. It's not so much I think what this gets at, distill it down, is you have a place of origin. Wherever the parents were, may or may not be where the child was born, may or may not be where the child grew up or has grandparents or goes to school or anything else. But you have a place where there was parents together and then there was a separation for whatever reason. My point is, and I think the point that this bill addresses, and perhaps, yes, it could be clarified within the bill via amendment, but the point is, for one parent, for whatever reason, to move from that location in a way that puts serious strains on a bunch of subjective and objective considerations for the child welfare. So, here's a man and a woman living in Portland, Oregon. There's a divorce. There's a separation. Spouse A gets custody, and spouse A moves to Montana. That's the point I'm trying to address with this.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Yes, Representative Worth.
I'm still back to the whole idea that the court is considering the potential, at least geographical distance between the parents, because it did come up in the case. But so what I think you're, how I read it, are you asking that the geographical distance between the parents be considered in favor of the parent who happens to be or most likely to stay living in the location of where the divorce took place? Is it a matter of the parent moving away to be that in his or her disfavor? What if the parent is moving, a divorce takes place here, but the parent is moving away to the home that the kids grew up, the home location of where the kids originally grew up?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Worth, what I would see this happening is in a situation where a court is making this decision, making a custody decision, and I think we all know that it's usually not a cut or dry. It's more how it happens now. It seems to be a blended sort of almost a percentage. But nevertheless, my feeling with this bill and how this would be adjudicated by court is that if custody is granted to, we'll call it spouse A, the court would. And I don't know how this would be done. Once again, this has to be some flexibility and discretion with the court, and that's why this is not specific. It's generally vague. But the assumption would be that the court would say to spouse A, who has received custody, that, listen, you've received custody for X, Y, and Z reasons, but we're also concerned about geography, and we would ask that you not move to Montana or New Orleans or Boston, that you would stay within a reasonable place, and once again, we don't want to be too specific. Portland metropolitan area, if you're from Portland, Salem metropolitan area, within the state of Oregon, even is more reasonable, I think, to objective people than having a separation, having child custody awarded to spouse A and having spouse A move 2,000 or 3,000 miles away. I realize as I'm saying that it wasn't as clear as you were looking for, but I'm not. Once again, I don't want to, this specific thing, for all the reasons that have been brought up. I think we have to trend away from being exactly, and maybe that's a oxymoron when we're talking about statute, but it has to be, there has to be flexibility given to the court to first of all, what does geographic distance mean? Are we talking, Hillsborough to Gresham? Are we talking Portland to Miami? I think there has to be that discretion. I also think there has to be the discretion with the court to say, this is just one factor. This is not an all-determining factor. This is a factor that the court will consider and will take into consideration, but ultimately, once again, going back to point A, the best interest of the child or children are what is paramount, what is precedent, and everything else is to add to that.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and not to belabor the fact, but it seems to be very concise, as Representative Bruin has just stated, that Primary consideration is given to the interest and welfare of the child. Considering the relevant factors, adding in a geographical consideration, but in Pren 2, best interest and welfare of the child in a custody matter may not be determined by isolating any one of the relevant factors above considered. So I think that it seems to give weight to that consideration. Doesn't seem to be an overriding consideration, but all of the judicial flexibility. And then the third paragraph also indicates other things that should not, because in the event there is a potential for emotional or physical damage to the child, I think that it's trying to get to the best interest of the child as stated in the very first paragraph.
Okay, was more of a statement than a question. I appreciate
it. It was
that.
More of a statement, thank you.
Okay, we're used to that. any further questions of the witnesses? Thank you again for your testimony, and I have no other witnesses on this bill, I believe. I have Mr. Barlow, but I guess he left, is that correct? Okay, see no further witnesses, then the public hearing on House Bill 2888 is concluded. Thank you. What's the will of the committee in proceeding with the last bill? We're going to run out of time no matter what, and I don't know what your obligations are on the floor this morning. Do you prefer to adjourn or...
Do you think it's going to take a long while?
We've had Professor Green, who had, I think, waited to testify at 20:09.
All right, that's probably a good way to go. I'll reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2912 and call Mr. Professor Green back, please. I'm going to have to, it's obvious we're not going to be able to complete the public hearing within the time allowed, so I apologize for that. This is the first time we've run over our time. We'll take this witness's testimony and then make a decision whether we can proceed or whether we should continue the public hearing.
Committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak. I'm Professor Stephen Green from Willamette Law School. I actually work across the street, and so I'd be happy to let someone else speak who travels the distance, if that would be the preference. Real quick, I've submitted written testimony, so I don't need to go over it. I guess I just want to make three quick points. One is that I study this area quite closely, and while I commend Representative Hunt for his intents here, I have not seen an overwhelming need for this piece of legislation, and I'm always concerned when we're talking about the interaction between church and state for there to be any kind of potentially unnecessary legislation that affects religious rights, or at least that ground between church and state. Second, I think it needs to bear in mind that any type of enhanced accommodation of religious rights in the state comes at a cost both to government, comes at a cost also to third parties who may be impacted by this. Just to clarify a point that Representative Hunt, I think, was unclear about the way that this works, this bill would affect private action, not just state action, in that you would have the state acting through a non-discrimination law, a fair housing law, or some other law that would in essence be enforced against a private individual who is covered by that law and saying you need to follow the dictates of this law. Then they would raise an exception to that, claiming that they have a free exercise claim that would counteract that. So that's where the state action comes into effect. It does, in fact, affect the actions of private individuals. But there are other private individuals who are also involved, and it's just something that this committee needs to keep in mind, is that whenever you enhance free exercise protection on one side, you may involve burdens on third parties as well as the government, and that should be kept in mind. Consequently, what I am neutral on this bill, whether it should be passed or not, but what I do recommend is, from what I understand, Representative Hunt was at least allowing for a proposed amendment to be circulated to change the standard of review from what we call strict scrutiny to intermediate scrutiny. And my testimony lays out why I think this is a good compromise, although I recognize that the 12 or so state references that exist out there in other states have the higher level of scrutiny. The reason I think that this is a good compromise is because it is not as strict, not as deferential to the state when it comes to these types of laws, but the same thing, it also doesn't hold the state to the same kind of level that it has to prove that these laws are necessary, and by adopting intermediate scrutiny, it would be consistent with the way we approach the rest of the First Amendment. And I'm sorry, but as a law professor who teaches this area, those things become important, and they become important for judges, too, that we have some consistency in the way that we apply the law. We're talking about neutral laws. We're not talking about laws that are intentionally designed to inhibit religious practice. And there are a host of neutral laws that would probably go down if you apply this high level of strict scrutiny. And so that's why I'm recommending that you adopt this amendment and instead impose what we call intermediate scrutiny, which is more of a balancing between the interest of both the governments, those third-party individuals, and then the religious claimants. That's the short review of my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative?
Professor Green, recognizing that you've offered or proposed an amendment if the bill moves forward, but going back to sort of the initial issue, in your view as a constitutional scholar, is there a problem in Oregon that needs to be addressed by this legislation, whether it's amended or not?
Representative McPherson, members of the committee, I have not seen that there is any type of groundswell or problem that exists out there with respect to inhibitions on free exercise. This becomes extremely subjective, of course. People on free exercise claims believe their claims very strongly. And so consequently, any type of governmental regulation that somehow keeps someone from fully expressing themselves, they may think it's an infringement on the free exercise. But generally, the courts have held there needs to be a substantial burden on that religious practice. Clearly, when people, at least in my opinion, are not engaged in those kind of core elements of religious practice, what goes on in a church or other things that are related to their institutions, and are out in the commercial marketplace and are engaged in certain types of business activities, such as already been suggested, renting apartments for commercial purposes. And then because some people come in who want to rent this apartment who don't fit their ideal of what is the appropriate relationship, then say, I should be exempt from the fair housing laws because this inhibits my religious belief to rent to a gay and lesbian, gay couple or a lesbian couple or an unmarried couple. In those instances, I would argue that probably is not a substantial burden on someone's religious belief system. Very different from the state laying down a law that you can't circumcise or you can't have wine at communion or something like that. There's a continuum that exists there. But in my opinion, most of the claims that we have seen that arise in this area, many of them do not represent substantial burdens, or most of the time they're accommodated informally by the religious figures. The four cases that Representative Hunt mentioned, two or three of those were relatively old cases, and my understanding, and I know we have someone from the Seventh-day Adventists here, that the case dealing with the Seventh-day Adventist school was decided on statutory grounds. It was not decided on constitutional grounds. This law would not affect that case.
Further questions? Seeing none, again, thank you for your testimony. Will of the committee, I've had the request to take two more witnesses. You're looking at the clock. Should we give it a try?
I just glanced.
Pardon?
I just glanced to see where we were. At your will, Mr. Chair.
Want to give it a roll and see where we go? Okay.
We'll wait a long time.
Yeah.
Greg Hamilton, Bob Castagna. Gentlemen, please come forward, and I'm sure you'll keep your eyes on the clock as we are. We go into session at 11. Usually courtesies take 45 minutes. But courtesies develop into a high art here now, so they take a good share of the morning. We might have a little bit, but I got to get back to my bills as quickly as I can. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, members of the committee. My name is Greg Hamilton. I'm president of the Northwest Religious Liberty Association, which is the government relations division of the Seventh-day Adventist Church in the Northwest. We represent approximately 35,000 church members in the state of Oregon, including two hospitals, as well as 35 elementary schools and three secondary schools. And we strongly support House Bill 2912 for several reasons, but I'll just get right to the issue here. It's been stated that somehow, or the question has been asked, why do we need a Religious Freedom Act in Oregon? That's the first question that comes up. The specific claim is that Oregon's legal precedents and statutes provide sufficient protection already to individuals and institutions of faith. From our perspective, this is false. Based on the free exercise legal precedents of the state of Oregon as currently interpreted by the Oregon Supreme Court, specifically in the case of Meltebecki versus Bureau of Labor and Industries, 1995, it ignores the compelling state interest in least restrictive means standards established prior to the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Employment Division of Oregon versus Smith, and fails to require the state to prove that it has a compelling interest when seeking to challenge and restrict religious practices under legal injunction. Second, if as Americans and Oregonians we believe, and this is moving to the general principle of common sense and why wait on the courts, the question is often asked, why not just let the court system, the legal system, work itself out if the Meltebecki case is all that's at stake here from 1995? And my response to that is, if as Americans and Oregonians we believe that the free exercise of religion is a fundamental constitutional guarantee, then House Bill 2912 is a state statutory amendment requires no particular parade of horribles to back it up as a means to persuade Oregon legislators of the need to restore this fundamental civil right in the state of Oregon. For me to argue that Oregonians must wait for egregious religious discrimination or intolerance to occur before seeing the need to restore protections against religious discrimination is to potentially place oneself in a callous and indifferent position towards the constitutional guarantee of every citizen in the state of Oregon, the right to practice their religion freely and without unnecessary interference. It can also send a chilling message to religious adherents, particularly faith-based and law-abiding religious minorities, that they are somehow outsiders and not welcome in Oregon. The question is sometimes asked, why is House Bill 2912 needed today if there's not widespread religious persecution in Oregon? This is because, at its core, religious freedom legislation is meant to be prophylactic. That is, forgive the pun, it's like, why would anybody take Ex-Lax? It's to prevent unintended consequences or to deal with current consequences. In other words, if one waits to seek legal protection until a minority group is being persecuted or discriminated against, it becomes politically difficult, if not impossible, to protect that group at that point. They will, by definition, at that time, be an unpopular minority with little legislative influence. A state must pass general protections ahead of time, long before the ire of the populace at large is focused on some small and unpopular group. A number of commentators have noted the importance of legislatures now acting to protect religious freedom rather than waiting for courts to act. And that's taken from Michael McConnell's Brigham Young University Law Review entitled Religious Freedom, Separation of Powers, and the Reversal of Roles. There's been some examples that have been put forward or questions that have been asked, one in regard to the Sunnyside Methodist Church situation. I don't want to answer for the Methodist Church here, but in that particular incident back in 1999, it was proven that the church had enforceable guidelines, were taking actions all along to prevent, to usher the homeless and people that needed help that they were feeding, to usher them home and walk them home, and wore specific coats that shined at night and so on and so forth. And so clearly it was disproven that somehow the church was being indifferent to the needs of the community. Also, the question was asked, what about somebody wanting to rent? Let's say someone who is religious decides they don't want somebody on their property to rent from them or lease or so on. Some people bring up the case in Alaska called Swanner versus Anchorage Equal Rights Commission in 1994, where protecting the choice of the landlord or employer with religious scruples, where they actually won out in the decision, where the tenant lost, who was of same-sex origin. And some might ask, well, you know, Why did they win? Well, there's a distinction that's often made between housing that is regarding fair housing, housing that is where you have tenants under your roof that are just living right below you versus, say, a landlord that lives miles and miles away, or a landlord that has many apartments and so on and so forth. That's the Alaska situation. At least a compelling governmental interest standard was at least used in Alaska. Today, if that circumstance were to occur in Oregon, there would be no compelling interest standard or precedent to go by, according to the Meltebeke case in 1985. That is my concern, and thus why I believe a compelling governmental interest is a necessary standard, because it provides fairness to both parties. You can go either way. Certainly the government can say that there's a compelling governmental interest in terms of fair housing and general welfare in such situations. That needs to be determined in each and every context. So I think that's important to remember when we talk about potential discrimination against third parties. And so, anyway, all in all, we believe, the Northwest Religious Liberty Association and the Seventh-day Adventist Church, we would like to recommend that this bill be move on to a work session and be passed. Thank you.
Next.
Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, for the record, Robert J. Castagna, General Counsel and Executive Director of the Oregon Catholic Conference. The Oregon Catholic Conference is the public policy voice of the Catholic Bishops of Oregon. In service to Oregon's Catholic population of more than 425,000 Oregonians, in pursuit of the common good for all Oregonians, the conference is here today to indicate its strong support for House Bill 2912. We do this at the urging of the Office of General Counsel, United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, which has urged all state Catholic conferences around the country to seek state RFRA legislation. 12 states have already done so. We are joined in our support today. Paul Cosgrove could not be here. He had to be elsewhere. But the United Methodist Church Oregon-Idaho Conference also joins in support of House Bill 2912. Mr. Cosgrove asked me specifically to mention the Sunnyside Methodist Church, which costs that church significantly as a result of their attempt to run a meal program for the homeless. We had the sad experience with the taping of the confession in Lane County in Eugene a number of years ago, and even though the Sunnyside Methodist case and the Machitis case were resolved ultimately in the church's favor, both religious bodies were put to significant effort and expense to uphold their religious free exercise claims. This type of legislation would put government bodies on notice that freedom of religion and its free exercise is a fundamental right subject to strict scrutiny, and that's why we support this legislation.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions from what's left of our committee? Counsel.
I just have one quick question, and maybe well, I'll just ask it. Right now, if the court finds that there is a substantial burden on somebody's religion, placed on somebody's religion based on some law, what standard of review is used to review that sort of case?
It's a lower standard of review, it's my understanding. According to the cases that we have in Oregon, they're following a similar standard as the U.S. Supreme Court, law of general applicability, neutrally applied. So it's certainly not a compelling state interest with least restrictive means or a strict scrutiny type standard.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair. Is there a difference? Does the court distinguish between an incidental burden and a substantial burden, or is that review, is that test no longer used?
Mr. Chair, committee counsel, it may depend on the factual circumstances. I don't know.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions from committee? What's left of the committee? Counsel? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Yes.
I'm going to, unfortunately, have to conclude the public hearing at House Bill 2912 at this time. Apologize for having kept you waiting, but I see a lot of familiar faces, and I know that you'll be back.